are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. South Dakota's Mathis family murders brought death and deception to the heartland. It was perhaps the most infamous murder case in state history. LaDonna Mathis was shot twice in the head at point-blank range inside the family's metal shed, serving as their makeshift home. Two of her three children, ages 2 and 4, were also shot in the head. The brutality of the killing shocked the state and set off a frenzy of law enforcement activity. Despite its intensity, the investigation never found the murderer or the murder weapon. Though charged with the crime, the husband was acquitted, leaving the door open for endless speculation about what really occurred on that late summer morning of September 8, 1981. With renewed insight from those involved, veteran South Dakota journalist Noel Hamill explores this cold case of murder and mystery that still haunts the Mount Rushmore state. The book that we're featuring this evening is South Dakota's Mathis Murders, Horror in the Heartland, with my special guest, journalist and author, Noel Hamill. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Noel Hamill.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much. First off, tell our audience your connection to this area and to this story.
I practiced journalism in South Dakota most of my career. I was born and raised here, and although the crime happened 40 years ago, it haunted me all those years for two reasons primarily. One, it was never solved. As you mentioned, the husband was acquitted. There were no other suspects who were detained or arrested. And two, the heinous nature of the crime. Two young children and a farm wife, both shot in their sleep at Point Bank in the Grange, and I just decided on retirement that I would take the time and research it and see if I could pull something together.
Now, tell us about this little community, Mount Vernon, and also about the Mathis family itself and the circumstances they find themselves in, that they're living, as we talked about in the introduction, in a makeshift home. What are the reasons for that? And just tell us a little bit about the family itself and its makeup.
Well, the Mathis farm is about 8 miles north of Mount Vernon, which is a small farming community in South Dakota, one of many, many small farming communities. But in July of that year, their house suffered an electrical fire. It had started in the basement. It was deemed suspicious, but no charges were ever brought. 2 weeks later, the house again caught fire, this time maybe because of a lightning strike. The house was uninhabitable. And so the family decided to move into a metal machine shed, actually a multi-purpose shed, just close to the home. And they moved their beds in there and they decided to live there until a new house could be built. It was somewhat primitive. They didn't have indoor plumbing or indoor bathrooms, but they decided that they could live there until the new house was completed. So that's why they were in this makeshift home at the time of the murders.
And you say that it was a typical farm family. They were church going and seemingly no enemies. But take us to September 8th, 1981. And the deputy sheriff is a man named Doug Kirkus. And he gets a call at home at 3:54 a.m. from somebody that he knows that he went to school with, a John Mathis. What does John Mathis essentially say to him? And then tell us about what Sheriff Kirkus encounters when he arrives at the farm.
Well, as you mentioned, they were actually classmates at Mount Vernon High School. Small school, 27 in the class. They knew each other. Deputy Kirkus lived in Mount Vernon. And when the call came in from John Mathis, John Mathis said something to the effect, Doug, come quick. Somebody's shot my family. So Kirkus immediately dresses himself, goes out the door, and drives at high speed to the Mathis place. What he finds there is, you know, a Mathis farm. he's a little bit concerned because he doesn't know if the murderer is still on site or is lurking behind the building. Maybe he's still in the machine shed. He doesn't know any of this. So he's very cautious, but he quickly discovers that he's not alone. He sees headlights approaching, and it's actually John Mathis's father who is also arriving at the place. And when he gets out of his vehicle, he sees that the elder Mathis is carrying a long gun. And so Deputy Kirkus gets out of his car and they approach the building together.
Now, what do they find the conditions of the Mathis family?
Well, they open the door carefully, again, for the reasons that I've mentioned. And what they see is John Mathis kneeling at the bed of one of his children. They approach him and see that he's wounded. Kirkus sees that he has sustained a wound to his left arm, and they don't see anything else in the building. But Kirkus then looks at the beds containing LaDonna Mathis and Brian Mathis and Patrick Mathis, and he sees immediately that they've been shot. And he tries to engage John Mathis, but Mathis himself is injured and seems to be in some kind of shock. Kirkus administers a bandage to his wound, and by that time, of course, the other help is on the way.
So what is the story that John Mathis relates to authorities?
John Mathis tells Deputy Kirkus that he was awakened at some point during the evening by his youngest son, Patrick, who is 2 years old, and his son told his dad that he needed to go potty. And as I said, they don't have a bathroom, but they have a bucket over by the door. And so John Mathis helps his son relieve himself in this bucket, puts him back to bed, but decides since he's up, he'll go out and check his livestock. He raises hogs, and he wanted to check on some livestock. So he did that. And on his return to the metal building, he told Deputy Kirkus that the door burst open and this man rushes him, rushes out of the building, wielding a gun. John Mathis says that he struggled with the man, tried to grab the gun, did not succeed. The gun goes off, shoots him in the arm, and he, at some point, passes out for 20 or 30 minutes or longer. And he relates this to the deputy, and he said when he woke up, he went into the building and called Kirkus. And the masked man was, I think it was a hood, as I recall, that he described he was wearing.
Now, from that account, he's taken to the hospital for his wounds.
Yes.
But from that account, you say authorities begin a extensive search of the property while people are also going to the hospital. Authorities are going to the hospital to question Mathis. So tell us about this search.
Well, one of Kirkus's jobs, or one of the things that he did when he was alerted, is that he called dispatch, who in turn alerted Sheriff Lyle Swenson and also the Department of Criminal Investigation, which is based in Pierre. But they have other agents. And so investigators from the DCI arrived on the scene that morning. Sheriff Swenson arrived, and the investigation at the scene begins, trying to find any clues they can to who committed the murder and possibly a murder weapon, anything that investigators could do to try to shed some light on this case. So that happened right away that morning after John Mathis was taken to the Methodist Hospital in Mitchell so that his arm could be treated.
Tell us about what is found at that crime scene in terms of bullets or spent cartridges, and also tell us what is written on the shed in gold spray paint. And by the way, the name, a part of what's written is misspelled. Tell us about this.
Yeah, an oddity on the large doors to the machine shed, which allows heavy equipment to be moved in and out, someone had spray painted in gold paint, Mathis sucks shit. I hate to say that to your audience, but that's what it said. But they misspelled the Mathis name. They spelled it M-A-T-H-U-S. And so That was spray painted on the door. And investigators saw that. They also found five spent 22 caliber cartridges inside the building, adjacent to the crime, to where the murders occurred, between the beds, near the beds. And then they, not right away, but later on, found a sixth cartridge outside the door. So in all, they found six 22 caliber cartridges at the scene.
So they don't find anything in the first day of an investigation of searching the property, despite this extensive search. So they decide to search further on this property, don't they?
They expanded their search outside the building. This is a pretty typical farmstead. It had a number of outbuildings, nine, I believe. And so they began to search each building and around each building for other clues. What they really want to find, of course, is a murder weapon. They conduct that search in coming days. One of the things that they had to do, since this was a hog operation, they had holding tanks for hog waste. They had to pump those out. They even had a large, we call it a waste pit, underneath the hog building that John Mathis had visited earlier that morning. They had to pump it out down to 4 feet, and then they sent two personnel in wetsuits to try to see if there was a gun that had been thrown into this pit under this building. The search was extensive. They didn't find anything on the farmstead. They started looking at the road ditches and land that immediately surrounded the farm. They walked. They had a lot of people involved. They rode horseback in the ditches. They were about as thorough as they thought that they could be, but they found nothing.
You talk about the two people, the two detectives at the hospital questioning Mathis, and his story, as you write, seems to add detail and somewhat change. Tell us what he does say to Kirkus and Greeling at the hospital regarding, again, hearing a car and other details that he added to his story.
Well, he did say that when he went outside after he had helped his son, he did say that he thought he heard an engine running, but he couldn't determine where it was. And he also said that his dog was barking, and so he wanted to put his dog away as well. But he wasn't, I guess those are the two things that he mentioned, I guess, because he you know, again, to support the narrative that there was this hooded man that committed these murders. But maybe the revelation from a law enforcement perspective at the hospital was that they found a unspent bullet in John Mathis's pocket. And he told investigators that, his son had found that lying in the ground, and he brought it to his dad. And so that's where that bullet had come from. And so yet another, you know, bullet added to the mystery of bullets and cartridges at the murder scene.
Now, how do police proceed with this investigation regarding this masked man? How serious do investigators take this assertion that this masked man, and do they look at any other potential suspects?
Well, initially, they didn't have any reason to be skeptical of John Mathis's story. After all, I mean, here's a man that lives with his family in a metal building. He's the one that reported the crime. He said, "Get out here quick. Somebody shot my family." And so they do. I guess the first inkling that the law enforcement had suspicions was that when they investigated the area in front of the building where this struggle took place between John Mathis and the hooded man, and where John Mathis said he was shot, investigators were not able to find any evidence of a struggle. They didn't find any tracks there. They didn't find any blood there. And if he was shot and lying there on the ground for 20 or 30 or more minutes, they thought, well, there ought to be some evidence of that. There ought to be some bloodstains on the ground. They were not able to find any. And that was very early on. And so with that in mind, they became suspicious, yes, of John Mathis.
You tell me that Svensson believes that he takes a call from a psychic, Dorothy Allison. Tell us about this strange part of the story.
Dorothy Allison was a a psychic from New Jersey who claimed to have helped law enforcement solve a number of crimes. Perhaps the most famous one was the Patty Hearst crime. So the psychic said that she would be glad to help, and Swenson was interested. This came a little bit later on, after they were unable to turn up anything on the place. She offered to help. She had enough information about the crime that Swenson thought that maybe she would be valuable. But the state didn't want to have any part of that. The state figured that if a psychic was brought in on the prosecution side, that they would be laughed out of town. They just didn't want any thing to do with a psychic. And Swenson never pushed that, but it was an interesting sidelight to the case, because they were having no success in solving the case. They couldn't find any suspects other than the husband. They couldn't find the murder weapon. And so they were, I don't want to say desperate, but they were looking for help wherever they could find it.
You talk about the Attorney General, Mark Meyer-Henry.
Yes.
He believed at this point, a few weeks in, that despite the stalled investigation somewhat, that he had enough evidence to empanel a grand jury. And so he would hear testimony from witnesses connected to the case. Who did he get to assist him, and how do they proceed?
They had a team, five or six people involved in the state prosecution. Mark Meyer-Henry was the state's attorney general at that time, highly regarded, experienced. He looked at the investigation that had been conducted by the DCI and the sheriff's office and determined that they did have enough evidence to ask for a grand jury to be impaneled, which it was. They presented their evidence to the grand jury, and very shortly the grand jury indicted John Mathis. So, you know, I would say that Meyer-Henry, in consultation with the investigators, determined that there weren't any other suspects. John Mathis was the only suspect that made any sense, and so they asked for an indictment, and they got it.
Now, there's a new judge, Thomas Andhurst, but Mathis is given bond. But a couple of the conditions are very interesting, as we read in the story, that he was to not contact a neighbor named Kim Tatum, which happened to be the family babysitter, and also LaDonna's parents, the Gerlachs, who were taking care of their infant son, Mathis' infant son, Dwayne, during the time of these murders and during that home renovation. So tell us about Kim Tatum and what she has to say.
Kim Tatum was the neighbor girl who, from age 13 or 14, had been coming over. They lived directly across the road from the Mathis place, within walking distance. And she had been retained by John Mathis to help with chores on the farm since she was 13 years old. The reason that he was ordered not to have any contact with her or her family was because he had an interest in Kim Tatum that went beyond just an employer-employee relationship. He was kind of smitten by Kim Tatum, even though she was young. And so one of the conditions was that he couldn't have any contact with her or her family. The Gerlachs, LaDonna's parents, who were taking care of the eight-month-old Dwayne, he was also forbidden to talk to them during this time as well. So those were two conditions that the court imposed. By the way, you mentioned Andhurst. He was the second judge. Judge Boag was the judge who ordered the grand jury. And after that indictment, John Mathis asked that he recuse himself, which he can do, because he didn't think that Mathis didn't think that he could get a fair trial in Mitchell and wanted a new judge, which was granted.
We talk about this grand jury that's impaneled. They learn a lot of information. And of course, as a reader, we learn a lot of information about John Mathis, his father, Vern, and his mother, Pearl. He was born in 1951, and he had two siblings, Vern Jr. and Norma Jean, his sister. And they talk about how LaDonna Gerlach and John Mathis met. So tell us a little bit about what's found out about how they met and when they were soon married.
Well, it's pretty common in small rural communities, you know, to have dances or other public events. And John Mathis met LaDonna, who was out of high school, working at a bank, smart girl, attractive. He met her and the courtship ensued, and the families were fine with it. The Gerlachs thought that he was an up-and-coming young man. He was family was successful, and so there was no reason to not endorse that marriage. From the Mathis standpoint, he was looking for a mate, somebody could help him with the farming operation, somebody who was smart, and LaDonna Mathis filled the bill. So, yeah, they met and were married.
And in terms of anything particular about his personality, you talked about that from all accounts, he was just a hard worker. They had his best friend talk about how they were both very, very interested in farming only. He didn't play any extracurricular activities in school whatsoever. He joined the National Guard after he graduated, and he was considered by everybody as quiet, not a fighter, and didn't use drugs or alcohol.
Yeah, he was, some people might even call him introverted. His father, by all accounts, Vern Sr., was an authoritarian type of dad. And John Mathis grew up in a household where hard work was expected, actually insisted upon. If John Mathis went to a dance or some other activity and got home late, his dad would make sure that he was up all the earlier the next day. Hard work, by all accounts, was what John Mathis was about. He didn't have hobbies. He would work till 1-2 o'clock in the morning, his neighbors said, and his family said. So that's the profile that emerged of John Mathis. LaDonna, it was a good partnership because LaDonna was the business end of the operation. She'd worked in a bank. She was good with figures. She tried to, if John wanted to buy a piece of expensive equipment or something of that nature, she would make sure that they looked hard on it and maybe didn't make that purchase. And so she was sort of the business end of the operation, and John Mathis was the worker. But he was also fairly creative. I mean, he could fix things, he could renovate things. He ran a good operation.
Now, with this grand jury, there's enough information to inform the prosecutor, and that they have enough evidence, to go to trial. And so that trial is delayed a couple times, but it's set for April 1982. So tell us who the adversarial team is. So you talked about the prosecutor, Meyer Henry. Who is the defense team set for this historic South Dakota trial?
One of the more interesting aspects of this case is that Mark Meyer Henry, who'd been elected attorney general in South Dakota, was from Gregory, South Dakota, another small community, farming community. The lead defense attorney, Rick Johnson, was also from Gregory, and he and Mark Meyer Henry were in the same high school. They played football together. Johnson was a couple of years ahead of Mark Meyer Henry, but they were in the same school, and they were actually grew to be good friends. They were both attorneys. They went to the same law school, the University of South Dakota, and they were good friends. So when Mathis needed defense help, he called the Johnson law firm, and Rick Johnson and his associate, Wally Heckland, another ranch boy from that area, took on the Mathis defense. And so, yeah, their wives were good friends. It was one of those little quirks of fate that happens. You have a high profile murder case, which had been moved from Mitchell, Davison County, to Yankton on a change of venue, because right. Johnson and Eklund contended that the pretrial publicity was such that Mathis couldn't get a fair trial in Davison County, and Judge Anhurst granted that change of venue. But the case involved, I would say at that time, that the Johnson law firm was one of the top two or three defense firms in the entire state. So it did pit the best defense attorneys against someone who was perceived as an excellent attorney general.
And this was a death penalty case if they dared to do that. And what was the press reaction to this case?
Well, it was the press statewide was all over this case. It's a very high profile case. because of the nature of the case, a farm wife and two children murdered in their sleep. The accused was the husband. The nature of the case was one thing. You had the principals in the case being the attorney general's office versus the one of the leading defense law firms in the case. That was another part of it. But I think just the singular nature of the crime itself. You know, South Dakota's had a fair number of high-profile murder cases going back to 1877 with Wild Bill Hickok in Yankton. But now Yankton was the site of easily the most famous murder case since then.
Let's use this opportunity, Noel, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. I'm excited to travel this summer. Have you ever thought about all of the people that make a vacation truly great? Like the hotel concierge who knows the best places to go, or the tour guide with great stories and other great suggestions while you're on vacation. You know, outstanding talent is crucial for a successful business. And if you're hiring, you can find talent for roles like these and more at ZipRecruiter when you try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that makes it easy to filter, review, and rate your candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So, travel to this easy-to-remember web destination, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's where you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, Noel, we were set for this trial, and the adversarial teams that were set, very, very talented, and not going to take anything personal. These people were in this battle for serious. It's not usual, but John Mathis and his team decide that he should testify. So tell us how they open up this trial, the earliest argument, what basically the prosecution, the center of their case, and what the defense says is the center of their case, and how this trial proceeds.
Well, the prosecution had determined that John Mathis committed the murder. They looked around at the evidence. They couldn't find any reason to believe that there was a masked man. They couldn't find any evidence of a struggle. They decided that the wound of John Mathis must have been self-inflicted. They brought in experts in the trial, that blood sample experts, ballistics experts, and they decided that really, mainly by the process of elimination. I know Mark Meyerhenry said sometimes a case is, you look at what's not there, and that controls the charges that you bring. And they decided that there wasn't any other suspects, and that John Mathis had made up this story. Their case was, and I can get to that later, but it was a circumstantial case, which doesn't mean that it isn't a good case. It just means that sure, they didn't have the evidence maybe that they wanted. The defense, on the other hand, said that no, John Mathis was a loving father. It happened as he said it. And by the way, the prosecution did a slipshod investigation. They didn't consider other suspects. There's other possibilities that they didn't investigate, and they brought in their own battery of experts to try to counter what the prosecution did. It was unusual, I guess, to have John Mathis testify, and he did testify. The defense thought it was important that he tell his story. He told the same story at trial as he did during the investigation, although the prosecution was quick to point out that there were some differences in the testimony that he gave during the grand jury compared to what he gave at trial. But basically, he told the same story at trial, and despite prosecutor Meyerhenry's best efforts, they weren't able to break him down at trial, and his testimony pretty much stood under a withering attack by Meyerhenry. There was one case where Meyerhenry point blank, asked him about his relationship with Kim Tatum, because that was the primary motive that they had settled on. And that was one of the areas where his story did vary a little bit. You know, initially he said during grand jury that he only touched her once. And by the time the testimony at trial occurred, he had to acknowledge that there was more to it than that. Although it was described as a quasi-sexual relationship, there was never any sexual intercourse.
What I found most interesting, despite what you said there, is that Kim Tatum said some very interesting things that she attributed to John regarding his regret over being married before he met her. Tell us what she claimed he had said.
Well, Kim Tatum acknowledged that they had had this ongoing, I'll just call it a touchy-feely relationship. And she always said that she didn't get anything out of it, but he must have because he kept doing it. And she would tell him to stop and he would stop. But at some point, he said to her that he had wished that he had met her, Kim, before his current wife, LaDonna. And the prosecution seized on that, of course, as a key motivational factor. Meyer Henry was heard to say that, yeah, he flipped out. He wanted to start his life over. And Kim Tatum was it. And but there was never any testimony either prior to trial or at trial that Kim Tatum felt toward him as he did toward her.
You talk about at trial, the defense made the claim. They talked about the shoddy investigation. They also, again, this seems routine now. I've heard it many times before where they say, well, you didn't pursue any other, we think, are tangible other suspects. So, but the thing is that they did say was that the police did not check any engine, a vehicle at the farm that night to see that anybody had left, meaning Mathis had left, and it must have been connecting to the disposal of that gun, or that murder weapon. So tell us what they contend at trial regarding this.
Well, at trial, one of the charges that they made against the prosecution was that it was a slipshod investigation. For example, they didn't check the engine in John Mathis's pickup to see if he'd driven it. Now, this came later, and the investigators acknowledged that they didn't check it, because if they had, and say that they were able to discover that he had driven it, the engine was warm, that would be an indicator that he had left the place, maybe to dispose of the murder weapon. But they did not check his engine. It was later, not the first day of investigation, that a neighbor came by and said, you know, it's kind of strange, John Mathis always backs his pickup into that garage. And I noticed that it was driven in this time. And of course, the investigators wondered about that. But when asked about it, Lyle Swenson and other investigators said, look, the morning of the investigation, we had no reason to think John Mathis was a suspect. He's the dad. He's the husband. We didn't think that he had driven someplace because he had called in the crime. So that was the prosecution's explanation for not checking the engine that morning. The defense also accused the state of not pursuing other suspects. They said that it might have been drug related, might have been a drug related killing, a crime. They said that the blood sample testing, the ballistic tests, were not properly conducted, and they supported that because they had their own witnesses that contradicted the blood sample outcomes that were conducted by the prosecution's labs. So all these things were used by the defense to paint a picture that the prosecution's case was sloppily conducted.
When John Mathis was asked on the stand, I think this is very profound, when he was asked questions like, why would this masked man who was capable of shooting your wife in the head twice, your son in the head twice, and your other son, why they did not kill you? Why did they leave you as a witness? How did he answer tough questions like that?
You know, John Mathis was described by the defense as a person of low intelligence. They brought in psychiatrists, they brought in experts and said, you know, his IQ is somewhere in the 80s. He's not a smart guy. And yet his answers to the prosecution's questions when he was on the stand were striking. To answer your question about what he said when Meyer Henry asked him, you know, about, you know, aren't you worried about the murderer coming back? Why would he leave you alive and kill your family? And Mathis said, I wished he would have. I wished he would have shot me. That was his answer. And Meyer Henry said, well, why is that? And Mathis said, so I could be with my family. Now, that pretty much stopped the prosecution questioner, I think, in his tracks, at least momentarily.
There were other instances where he, again, said the right thing, and his very talented attorney elicited those kinds of responses from him. So he obviously, because of his acquittal, he really did do a good performance that the jurors seemed to believe. And but you say that one of the main things that was a hurdle or an obstacle was the notion. Again, it's hard to believe that in 1982, people had a hard time believing that a father would kill his kids, didn't they?
Mark Meyer Henry said in the very end that the reason that the state lost that case was because the jurors could not come to grips with the idea that a man could shoot his sons, much less while they were sleeping. It wasn't a case where he was in anger. It wasn't, you know, the kids had done something awful or they were misbehaved children. The jurors just couldn't believe that a dad could shoot his kids that way. Mark Meyer Henry, who I interviewed 4 months before he died, said that after trial. He said it during anniversary updates of the trial, and he said it 4 months before he passed. He thought he knew the jury in Yankton. He thought that he could get a conviction, but he said, I misjudged the jury. He said they couldn't sign on to that sort of a crime.
Let's use this, Noel, as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, we get to we talked about it, but the trial, the conclusion, the verdict with all these jurors, and you talk about, and you write, you identify these jurors, and there is follow-up interviews, especially with the jury foreman, and what he had to say was very, very interesting, so we can talk about that. But suffice to say is that he is acquitted. What is the press reaction, and what is the community reaction to this not guilty verdict?
The community reaction, I think, was one of skepticism, maybe even disbelief. I think the community at large, and I'm not just talking about, it was most pronounced in Mount Vernon and the region around Mitchell, but I think statewide people assumed that John Mathis would be convicted. And even his attorney said after the trial at different times that it was just so unfair for the people of South Dakota to continue to harbor the belief that John Mathis was guilty. He was acquitted. And Rick Johnson said more than once, he said, you know, it's just not right. Now, John Mathis himself, I think one of the titles was not guilty, but not free. And the media had done some retrospective stories about how he was coping with life afterward. And by most accounts, he was in many cases shunned. He never was, you know, extroverted or part of the community, but this pushed him even further into the background. So I think that he lived a lonely life following that, by all accounts. And I got that from interviews that I read. You mentioned the jury foreman, Hanemichael. He was one of the last holdouts of a guilty, and he and another juror finally came to the conclusion that the evidence just wasn't compelling. It wasn't enough to convict.
What about the bullet found by jurors on the first day of deliberation?
Oh, yes. Well, one of the defense's positions was that .22 caliber rifles are everywhere and bullet cartridges and bullets can be found everywhere because every farm and every ranch has one to shoot varmints with. And the defense used that as a way of explanation for the bullet found in his pocket at the hospital and other cartridges. The cartridges that were found by jurors was on the first day of deliberation. They had gone out to eat dinner. They were coming back to the jury room, and they spotted two spent .22 cartridges along the sidewalk. It was reported that one was found, and it was reported that two were found. But the fact is that the jurors spotted these two cartridges, and they were just shocked. And as Hanemichael and a couple of the other jurors said later, my gosh, I guess the defense was correct. I mean, these cartridges are everywhere. They're even on the sidewalk on our way back to the deliberation room.
Wow.
And keep in mind, this was after the trial was over. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is after all the summations were concluded.
Right.
This was during the deliberation process. And they did say in interviews following that those cartridges were something that they considered before they came in with the acquittal. The cartridges, I'll just say this, by most everybody's accounts, were plants. Somebody planted those to be seen by the jurors.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick Johnson was incensed that anybody would imply or accuse the defense team of doing it. He said, we didn't have anything to do with it. Don't know how it happened. But most observers, including the state person who later became a judge, said, yeah, they were plants because the bullets had been removed from the cartridges. They were never fired. The bullets had been removed. And then the casings were planted along the sidewalk.
You write that this story didn't go away, this most notorious South Dakota murder trial and case didn't go away. And you write about times that it came back up and there was interesting interviews with former players. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those developments that you found?
Well, one of the things that came up or continued to come up with regard to this case was what possible scenario would there be for the murder of these people? And one of the stories that kept coming up was drug related. And this is what the defense tried to plant in the minds of the jurors during the trial, was that the Mathis family was killed because there was one story out there that there'd been a drug party and Mathis had reported it. Law enforcement broke it up and people that were in the drug business in the Mitchell area were incensed. And so they ordered the hit. Gary Hanemichael, years later, contended that he knew what really happened and the real cause of the Mathis murders. And he was quoted as saying it's much bigger than just the trial and what happened. But when he was asked to elaborate, he would not do it. And he didn't talk to, you know, law enforcement about his theory either, which remains a huge mystery in my mind. In fact, even though he had passed by the time I wrote the book, I did call his wife and asked her if she had ever discussed this theory with him or if he'd discussed it with her. And she said, no, he'd never discussed it with her. He just didn't think that John Mathis was smart enough to pull off the crime. So, you know, the jury foreman had this theory or speculations, and we'll never know what they were.
You include the infant that was kept at the Gerlachs, the Mathis infant, was named Dwayne. 30 years later, a story surfaces, and finally he comes forward to defend his father. Tell us what he had to say.
Dwayne Mathis was 8 months old. He was staying with LaDonna's parents at the time of the murders. He was raised by John Mathis at the farm. One of the newspapers, I believe in this case, it was the Mitchell Daily Republic, had done an anniversary story. And John and Dwayne Mathis had read the story, and he took it upon himself to call the newspaper and say, look, my dad isn't being fairly treated by the coverage. And the newspaper said, well, come on in, we'll talk about it. And so he did. He went to the newspaper office, he provided identification, and he said, you know, most of the coverage is very one-sided. If my dad was this monster that the press makes him out to be, I wouldn't be here today. My dad raised me, and he never, you know, he was not a severe taskmaster. He never beat me down or anything. You know, he might discipline me, but he raised me. And Dwayne said that I wouldn't be here today if he was the person that he's been made out to be in the press. I interviewed Dwayne Mathis for the book, and he said essentially the same thing. He still lives in the new farmhouse that was built following those fires. And he told me that when he goes into the metal building, he doesn't think about what occurred there. He says, I was only 8. I don't remember any of that. None of that has anything to do with me. And he lives where the murders took place.
Very, very interesting. Near the end of your book, you talk about the Firestell Nursing Home, where Vern Mathis Sr. resides, and a nurse's aide one day has a conversation with him. What does she claim he had to say? And as a result of what she claimed he had to say, what do police do?
A nurse's aide in Firestell Nursing Home decides to check on Vern Mathis Sr. before her shift ends. He'd not been well. And so I think her shift ended maybe at 11 o'clock, and she goes down to check on him. And while she checks on him, he says something to the effect that he has done something terrible. And she doesn't know what he's talking about, but he says he's done something terrible, and he, you know, is having trouble dealing with it. So she reports this to her dad when she gets home from her shift. Now, her dad remembers the Mathis trial. This young aide, I think she's maybe 19 or 20 at the time. She doesn't know anything about it, but she reports it to her dad. Her dad immediately contacts law enforcement. Now, keep in mind, Vern Mathis Sr. by this time is quite elderly and has had health issues. But law enforcement goes over there to interview him twice. The first time is you know, I mean, nothing really is gleaned that they think is too informational. Then two other law enforcement people interview him, and they asked him about the weapon, which is, of course, one of the big mysteries of the crime. And he, you know where the weapon is, Mr. Mathis? And he says something to the effect, well, wherever you find it. And he's asked if he had anything to do with the planning of the murders. And he said, absolutely not. The episode is interesting because it suggests that the elder Mathis perhaps knew more than came out during the trial. But when he's interviewed by law enforcement, there isn't anything forthcoming that law enforcement would decide to, say, reactivate the case. But it was an interesting episode. And of course, he's passed on by now. And it was absolutely shocked this nurse's aide, and she was really affected by it.
You also include right at the end here, when we talk about Dorothy Allison and the Svensson was interested in enough to call her and take her information very seriously. She had helped out, she had claimed, in 14 cases, she had been provided crucial information. You provide right at the very end the conversation that Svensson had with this Dorothy Allison, and just her perceptions, her psychic perceptions, were very, very interesting. Tell us about that.
Well, Dorothy Allison did claim to have been instrumental in solving a number of cases, including the Patty Hearst case. And Svensson was intrigued by her because, keep in mind, they couldn't find the murder weapon. The motive that they had ascribed to Kim Tatum was not the strongest motive. There was no insurance motive because I believe the insurance was $60,000 and the prosecution decided that wasn't enough to be a real motive. Mm-hmm. So Svensson was thinking that this psychic might be of help. And she told him by telephone, she said she smelled smoke. And he knew that the house had burned. She gave him some numbers that he determined were the license plate numbers off of John Mathis's pickup. Now, could she have gleaned that information other places? This case got widespread coverage. I don't know the answer to that. But he was intrigued by it. But he also knew that Meyer Henry and the state wanted to distance themselves from a psychic. They said and believe that if there was even a hint of the state relying upon a psychic, the press would be all over it. And so that never transpired. But I think Svensson was tempted. He was grasping at straws in some respects, and he placed some credence in what the psychic said.
Yes, absolutely. An incredible case. You talk about just in the end as well that about the fate of John Mathis in that community.
Well, you know, it's kind of in many ways, a sad ending. John Mathis farmed for years thereafter, and then his son said that they lost the farm in the 1980s. John Mathis continued to work for, I believe, a neighbor in their farming operation. He never remarried. He retired. To my knowledge, to this day, he still lives in Mitchell. As I said earlier, his son lives on the farm. The case, while unsolved, is definitely inactive. Many years after that case, Mark Meyer Henry was contacted and asked if the case ought to be reopened and reinvestigated. He says, no. He said, that'd be a waste of taxpayers' money. We thought we had the right person, the right case, and it didn't happen. So again, nobody was ever punished for that, for those murders. And that's one of the intriguing aspects of the case.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Noel Hamill, for coming on and talking about South Dakota's Mathis murders, Horror in the Heartland. I know this is a History Press release, and I want to thank you so much. This was just recently released. Can you tell us just when it was released and about History Press?
Okay, so it was released April 25th this year, so it's a little over a month. It's, as I'm told by History Press, which is part of Arcadia Publishing, they focus on histories and regional stories. I'm told that it's available online, you know, through Arcadia Press, but also through Amazon and your major bookstore outlets or in local bookstores here in Rapid City. So that's what I can tell you about the book.
I want to thank you so much, Noel Hamill, South Dakota's Mathis Murders, Horror in the Heartland. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Noel Hamill, good night.
Thank you for having me.
Good night.